Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and joining me today is Jeff Clossy.
Hey, Jay. Good morning, man.
Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Is it?
It is.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad it's good to be with me.
I'm glad that you're glad.
I was supposed to ride my bike to work today.
Oh, yeah? What happened?
I was late.
So you didn't get to get on it?
No.
Yeah.
I did it yesterday.
I know. That was good. I was glad that you did it. So I've got one ride in for the summer. Was that your first?
We
both one.
So.
One.
Yeah.
You've only
ridden your bike once.
Yeah.
This summer?
Well, into work. I haven't been riding a whole lot. We just had other things going on. But so I used to be a bike rider. That's how I feel right now.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you rode yesterday. It was a beautiful day for it.
I didn't even get all I did to get my bike ready was pump up the tires.
That's all you need.
Is it?
Yeah.
I mean, the brakes worked.
Yeah, exactly. And brakes are optional. Come on, let's be honest. There's all kinds of ways of...
I shifted a couple of gears and tested the brakes and pumped up the tires.
And you wear a helmet, so...
And off I went.
And you made it.
And I did. I made it here and I made it home. And then this morning, I was like, oh, this is a nice day today and tomorrow it's supposed to rain, so I should do that. And I allowed myself extra time and then... That extra time went away. Has that ever happened to you? Probably not.
That's why I haven't ridden much this summer.
Seriously? Like, do you plan and then it doesn't?
Yeah, it's just stuff comes up. Yeah.
I find it amazing how little bits of time add up and just disappear. And I see it, but it drives me crazy in my house because nobody else, like, everybody estimates time of like, oh, it's a 4-minute drive to that place. So we need to leave 4 minutes ahead of when we need to be there, not counting the time that it takes to, you know, put on shoes or walk out to the car or get seated or, you know, like all that stuff adds up. And so that's kind of what was happening today. I was like all ready and was just sitting there drinking my coffee and kind of just trying to, you know, just have some quiet time. And then when I went to go, it was like, oh, I also have to grab this. Oh, I forgot this. Oh, and then by the time I'm looking at it, I realized, oh, we need to be recording in 15 minutes. And I am a 12 to 13 minute bike ride. And so. The math didn't work. Because at that point, I'm like, yeah. And by the time I grab my bike and get it out. And like, so this is not what people tuned in to hear. The woes of a bike
rider. I'm sure people
can
relate though, because not necessarily the bike part, but it's amazing how, especially in the morning, things can go so differently so quickly than what we anticipated. And I think that the topic from Sunday relates to that. Like, how do you respond to that? And so we're in the middle of this Hebrews 11 faith chapter and all these, I don't know if we call them heroes of the faith, like if that's a typical way of saying it, but they're examples of faithfulness, right? But then there's like the other side, and that's where we went on Sunday, and every one of them is, because they were human, and broken humans, they trusted, and they doubted. And that's where you went Sunday, and you had five pitfalls, and I think that what happens in our morning routines is where this plays out. That's like the moment where it matters is... How do I respond in that?
Yeah.
In the instance of like, yep, that didn't go well. Or like, especially when we anticipate it not going well, we try to prevent, you know, like a lot of times that can happen. It's so disappointing. But yeah, you came up with five on Sunday and I thought they were all very applicable to our experience of life. And, I'm curious as you were prepping that, the five you came up with, we can walk through those. To me, where you went with it, it was so practical and so helpful. And it's actually not really the author of Hebrews doesn't go through those stories.
No.
Right? He doesn't give the underside. So I'm curious the mind frame you were in to go there. Like, how did you decide that that was important?
I mean, it's a good question. It was because I was looking at, because we had tried to figure out how do you handle Hebrews 11, and anybody that's preached through Hebrews, any church that has done that, there are a lot of different ways to handle Hebrews 11. One is you just do one sermon on faith and just call it good and just cite all those examples, because the main point isn't any one of those stories. The main point is what faith is and what it looks like. And the author saying it's always been faith. It's never been about the law. It's always been about faith. And look, here are all these examples, all the people you look to in the Old Testament that are your examples and heroes in the faith, in what it looks like to be faithful to God. This is what it looks like. They believed in something better and greater, and they showed it by these acts that they took. So you can do just one sermon, or you can do a breakdown of every character and spend, you know, you could do an entire sermon series in Hebrews 11, going back into the Old Testament. And we've kind of done a hybrid of that, of just saying, well, let's pick out a few to just show these examples. But for some reason, when I was looking at it and thinking, okay, I thought about preaching on Noah, I thought about preaching on Abraham and Isaac, I thought about preaching on, you know, Jericho. Like, there are all these examples. Rahab, I had a little outline for Rahab. But as I was looking at it, I just thought, man, sometimes what's not said in the text is important too, which you got to be careful in what you say in that. But by that, I mean, when we give kind of try to give three-dimensional thinking to what the hearers would have been hearing. And so anybody who's reading this letter or hearing this letter read to them back in the first century would have also known about all of these flaws in all of these people. There's no way that they're going to sit there and go, oh, wow, well, I guess Moses just like, he like rejected all the riches of the world and then just turned and like let him out. The way that the author is summarizing it, if you didn't know anything about Moses, you would think, oh, wow, what an incredible example. Well, anyone who's listening to that knows his whole journey and his whole, and so what does that say? Like both, what does it say that the author doesn't bring it up, which I tried to address at the end, and I'll probably address next week more. But also, what do we learn? What do we learn from that? Because I think sometimes we read sections like this, and like I had mentioned, it can feel overwhelming. It can just feel so. It's funny because I wish, in hindsight, I wish I would have, and I had organized it a couple different ways. It was not the easiest of messages to organize. It went through a lot of iterations. And even where I landed, I'm like, oh, if I could do it over again, I would probably say, I would want it to sound more positive, because it was a negative. I went negative. Like all the points were negative. But the reason they were negative is because that was the most obvious connection. Like the pitfalls, that's what I was trying to draw attention to. If I had gone with the positive, so for example, confess your doubt. So that could have been a point and maybe would have been more helpful, but then I have to make that connection between the confession of doubt to the lack of confession of doubt, which is what the story in Sarah, what Hebrews talks about with Sarah doesn't have anything to do with confessing your doubt. So I would have had to like make a lot of connections. And so I was trying to, one, as funny as it sounds now, trying to make it a little more efficient and a little more like cut to the chase, mm-hmm. and say like, hey, this is a pitfall. This is the other side of what we see in Hebrews 11, the shadow side of what's going on there. And this is what we can learn from it. And I thought the intent wasn't to go negative. The intent wasn't to like, the intent was to go relatable. Like I wanted people to hear that, yes, Sarah exercised great faith, but her faith wasn't flawless. Moses's faith wasn't flawless. Abraham's faith wasn't flawless. And I think we, if we are sensitive, I'm not talking about those who are hardened, but if you have a soft heart and you're sensitive to the Spirit, then you're going to feel that conflict. And the enemy is going to get in there and say like, well, you don't have that kind of faith. Look, you doubted. Or you're going to start thinking, oh, the reason why these bad things happen is I didn't have enough faith. If I just had faith like David had, you know, to slay the giants, then I would have slayed my own giants. And it's like, yeah, David did exercise great faith. He also has moments of just profound faithlessness. And, which is one of the reasons why you always mention and why we love the Psalms, because you see all of that playing out in real time. So that's a very long-winded way of saying I just felt like it was what our church maybe needed in the moment, to just take a step back and realize, hey, their faith is not perfect and our faith isn't. And just seeing in our culture how often we fall into these pitfalls. Mm-hmm. And why I went five is like, these are the ones as I'm reading the text. I just read the text and I thought like, oh, the kind of the shadow side of all of those stories, and thought what's most pertinent to us right now? What do we see the most? What do I see the most in shepherding this family that I think would be the most helpful to people? You know, I could have talked about Jericho, Rahab, kind of, there were some that I still could have, I narrowed it down to five. But I felt like I couldn't go to three. I was trying to get to three, but at the end of the day,
we had five, right?
We had five.
Yeah.
I tried to get to three, but at the end of the day, I just finally said, okay, I'd rather do these five shorter than, and then it ended up not being short. So like, whatever.
Well, it's a really important exercise for us as we follow Jesus and we want to be students of his word, to recognize, like, it can be so easy. I don't know if we even explicitly do it in our mind, but it's like we read about people in the Bible and we can sort of give them a status that is not quite human. And it's not necessarily even like superhuman. We just don't slow. I think some of it is we don't slow down enough to imagine what would it have been like to receive this news of, like, you know, Abraham and Sarah, the promise of a son after, you know, they didn't think they could have one. And because they were real human beings and not just robots in a story or just characters that an author made up, they have a mix of emotions. They have all kinds of experiences. And it's important for us to know that so that we can learn how to be faithful to Jesus in the moments where we struggle, and the moments where we don't understand what God is doing, and the moments when we're tempted to doubt his love for us or his care for us or his power to take care of us or all those things. So I think it's a really good exercise. And it, to me, it applies not just to Hebrews 11 and not just to the category of faith, but really to following Jesus, because we're humans. We can vacillate from great faith, from great confidence in him. But then in a moment, something can happen and that can all come crashing down. And I'm sure people listening, and I know I've experienced it, where that happens. Like, it can be day to day, it can be hour to hour, where we just change. And so if we believe that we are unique in that, I think all five of these things that you talked about will be our experience. But if we know and trust that we're not the first ones to experience that, in fact, that happens to God's people, and he's provided provision in the middle of that to deal with it. He's present when we feel those things. I think we're just much more well-equipped to deal with real life as it comes.
Yeah, and, you know, so you coach youth sports, and I'm sure you say something similar to this. There's a lot of different ways of phrasing it, but kids that I coached would hear me say a lot of, don't let one mistake turn into two. That was one of my youth coaches used to say that all the time. So you throw a bad pass, don't then go and foul the person that stole the pass. You what you're trying to do is stop the spiraling effect of mistakes or sin or brokenness or, you know, failure. Basically, you're trying to stem the spiraling effect of that. And so that's part of what I was trying to do there, is with doubt, just the realization that we all experience this. And so don't let it spiral. And if you can acknowledge it, so that's where, you know, seeing how, and I could have gone into this, that all of those, one thing, maybe the most impressive thing about all of these people, all these examples in Hebrews 11, is that they didn't let it spiral. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine Abraham as he's traveling, and then he lies about Sarah being his sister to spare his own life, because he thinks he's then going to be killed if he says that, you know, that they would just kill him and take her then, as so that he says, no, she's my sister. And so then puts her at great risk, like, as she gets turned over to the king to be his wife. You know, it's very strange. Well, that could have spiraled for mm-hmm. Abraham. He could have just been like, that's it, which is kind of what Moses does. Moses runs and hides in Midian for 40 years because he feels like, well, then I failed. Mm-hmm. Like, he murders the Egyptian. The Hebrews then don't trust him. So he's like, I killed an Egyptian. So that's going to get out. And so I'm going to die at their hands. My own people have rejected me. Like, they didn't see it as me defending them. They see it as like, I'm this. So I'm just going to run away. And I think if I could have drawn that out a little bit more, that might've been helpful too, to realize this is why it's so important to confront these things, because you don't, otherwise you spiral. And that's what the enemy wants. The enemy wants a little bit of doubt to get fed and to become like a self-sustaining machine of doubt. And mm-hmm. you and I see it all the time with mm-hmm. people. And I trace it back. I would say these five things are just the things I see all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, and we want to cultivate a culture here of genuine faith. And one of the things that all of us have experienced is being around people who put up a front of faith, because you're not allowed to admit you have any doubts. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to admit that you question, because if I do that, then God's not going to do what he says he's going to do, because I have to have, you know, even scripture talks about like not having an evil, unbelieving heart, like don't be double-minded and all these things. And so we kind of take that and think, oh, that means that I can't ever be weak in my faith. And so if I feel any weakness, I'm just going to pretend it's not there, or I'm just going to not say that it's there, you know, like, and we see that happen a lot. And then what that results in is fake.
Yeah.
You know, if you've ever been in any kind of Christian environment that you're like, this feels not genuine, that's one of the reasons. Is like, in cultures where you're not allowed to confess your unbelief, you're going to end up cultivating a culture where what's valued is just pretending like you have it all together, pretending like you're believing everything.
Yeah, that was where you started. That was the first of the five. The way you put it, or well, at least the way I wrote it, is we try to hide our doubt. We try to bury it and act like it's not there. And one of the points you made is that doubt then grows in the darkness. It's like that's the climate that it really loves, and it will just start to take off. And what we need to do, and I love how you went after it, is just to be honest about it, to bring it out into the open, is to, like, it's not to suffocate and smother it, but it's to take away the environment that it really thrives in. And sometimes by just even writing like what we're doubting, like I've known people where I've just asked them, just this week, take some time. If you're not able in the moment to articulate what it is that you're actually doubting, because sometimes doubt is a vague feeling, and that's actually really difficult. Yeah. It can just be like, I just feel this. But if we can actually get to the point where we can articulate it, even writing it in a journal can be super powerful. What we end up doing is we end up doubting our doubts. We end up wondering, maybe that doubt actually isn't valid, you know? And oftentimes what I have found in myself and in other people that I've walked with through doubt is that once you get past this like feeling of it and you start to articulate the actual content behind it and just be honest, it's not that the doubts just go away, but they lose their power. And I would say that living with a degree of uncertainty and doubt is not abnormal for followers of Jesus. And I think if we can with each other as brothers and sisters, just be honest about that, it does our souls very good. Because like you just kind of hinted at, the culture that basically believes we just need to pretend we believe things we don't and actually say we believe things we don't, that messes with your soul in a way that is, it's unbelievably harmful. It really is. And that actually, I think, is sometimes what people have experienced in church, is that. And it's like either being told you have to articulate and confess you believe something you don't, or just being around people that's the reality. And what ends up happening is a large focus on externalism and not the heart, because the heart is like, the heart actually seeks what is true and knows what is true all the time, what you believe is true. And but the externals can be what I think you want me to believe is true. And then you just have this people pleasing and all kinds of grossness that comes out of it. So I loved, like, part of the antidote that you gave was to speak it out. And I would say, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And in my own experience, even if I tell God that, yeah, here's what I'm doubting, and I start there, that can be so encouraging. But then even this morning, I've already had one conversation about this with someone. And just talking with anybody about it, it doesn't need to be a pastor, can be so helpful, and you can allow God to then minister to you through that person.
Yeah, because I think when you're, it's when those doubts are creeping in, if you think about it even as like a mixture and saying, okay, let's say you're 80% faith and 20% doubt, like belief versus unbelief. Well, when you confess it at 20% and you say it, then like 80% of you says, no, that's not actually what I believe. And is you're able, it, like you said, it takes away its power. But if it grows and grows to the where it's like 50-50, or it starts to tilt the other way, that's when that spiraling effect and that momentum really can take place. And I think just confessing it out loud, and then also being able to live in that tension. So one example I didn't give was there was a season for me where I really struggled to sing songs when I was struggling like with doubt, because I felt fake. I felt like a hypocrite. So one thing I wish I would have pointed out is to say, like, it's okay to live in that tension. I mean, that's what the story, you know, the healing of that boy reveals, is that the man says, I believe, help my unbelief. Yes. There's a confession that these exist in the same space. It's not all or nothing. And so when I feel like I'm questioning something, that doesn't mean that I don't actually believe. It doesn't mean that I don't actually have faith. And it's not hypocritical to declare things that I know to be true, even if I'm not feeling it in that moment.
Yep.
And that was an important thing. So like, not feeling something in the moment isn't the same thing as not believing. It's just, we're complex, and our belief and our faith is a combination of what we know intellectually, what we feel emotionally, how we act. Like, it's all of those things in concert. And sometimes you have to cling to what you know in the midst of, like, not what you're feeling in that moment. So I probably, if I could do that over again, I would probably say, yeah, confess your doubt, but then also confess your belief. Like, do both. Like, confess, this is what I believe. This is what I know. And then as you are doing that, yeah. And we should definitely spend more time confessing what we believe and what we know to be true than, you know, than what our doubts are. It's why our worship songs aren't full of like, I doubt you and I'm not sure. And I'm like there are lines in there that articulate that human experience of, you know, when I'm weak, when I don't believe, when I don't see, like there are lines, but the majority of what we sing are the declarations of what we know to be true, because ultimately that's what we want to spend more time doing. So I hope that nobody left that thinking like, oh, so the most important thing when I'm having doubt is to speak out my doubt. Like, there's a tension there, right? Mm-hmm. Like you want to confess what you believe also. Like,
right. And in that process of talking with God about it, part of what we'd expect to happen is that then you are also being filled with the knowledge of all the things that are true about Him. So it's a similar thing with lament, right? Where you're confessing your disappointment, your discouragement. You don't just stop there though.
Right.
Then you say, and God, I know you're faithful. I know you're full of love. You've done this for me. You've saved me. Your son has died on the cross for me. All of these things. And then you ask Him, but take away that, change that circumstance. You still do ask, but there's a process. And I would say, it's a similar process actually. You want to be reminded. And when I've had moments, in my past, where I have struggled, and I've shared about some of those, especially at the men's conference this last year, I shared about some of those and kind of my grace awakening. When I had the moment of like, is this worth it? Essentially, I was reminded of all the things I knew to be true factually about what God did in history through Jesus. And that is part of what you're getting at there, is that there ends up being a choice to trust. There really is. And that choice is dependent. That's why that prayer is so beautiful. I believe, help my unbelief, right? But in that prayer, you're acknowledging, I want to believe, I'm trusting you, I help me to trust you. It's an act of faith and obedience to believe what he has said to be true. It's acknowledging also his authority, that his voice is more authoritative than my feelings, and it's more authoritative than someone else's voice in my life as well.
Yeah, and this is where the tension of all this stuff comes in. So I was thinking of the tension of having a culture. If you want a culture of genuine faith, one ditch is that's not genuine is when you're in a situation where no one can confess any kind of doubt. Like we just are all gonna, everything's great all the time. But then the other ditch is to just say the only thing that's genuine is suffering or doubt, right? So there are other churches and people. We've seen that in a movement, a kind of deconstruction movement, where it's like, I don't trust somebody who says that they're joyful today, or mm-hmm. that they have faith. Like that has to be fake. And a healthy church with a healthy culture is going to have both of those things present. It's similar to lament and rejoicing. And we try to hold that tension. Like we often will acknowledge that on Sunday mornings that we want there are people on any given Sunday morning who are just, they have just been rejoicing in Christ. They've been just enjoying him, that they are in a moment, a place of just real, real joy. And we have people who are suffering on any given Sunday. And we want both of those experiences. We try to hold that tension a lot. We talk about, Mother's Day. Like, we don't want anybody feeling, you shouldn't feel guilty for rejoicing. You shouldn't feel like you have to come up with some kind of doubt so that it feels genuine. Like, you know, God gives the gift of faith to people, and he gives you moments and days where, man, it's so good. And it's just wanting to articulate that this is the tension that we're in. And ultimately, I think about the tension when people talk about faith, like it is blind faith. It means believing without, just how it gets characterized as blind faith. And we say, well, that's not true, but it's also not true that you see everything. Like, the whole point of Hebrews 11 is you're believing in what you don't see. Yep. So it is both. And I think a little bit of what we mean when we say that step of faith, or kind of a leap of faith, what it is it's, you're never gonna, like, we can't see everything. We're not capable of seeing everything. At some point, like you said, there's a crossroads, there's a moment, there's a choice of, okay, I have reasons to believe, but ultimately I'm still stepping into what is unseen and what is unknown. Mm-hmm. We don't see eternity, like we can't, and we don't see what's behind the physical. We can't touch it. And, so there is a little bit of a leap of faith, and that's what genuine faith ends up being, like, kind of like when you have some doubt or unknown, but you go anyway. It's a little bit like that definition of courage, that mm-hmm. courage is when you're afraid, but you go anyway. Mm-hmm. Courage isn't the absence of fear. If there's no fear, then there's no courage. Like, the whole definition of courage is overcoming, is saying this thing is important enough that even though I'm afraid, I'm still gonna go. Otherwise, if someone isn't afraid at all of jumping out of a plane for whatever reason, like there's just no big deal to them at all, then it takes no courage. Like, they're not courageous. You know, they might you might say that they're irrational. You might say other things about them, but they're not courageous. And I think sometimes we even miss seeing the evidence of faith in our own lives and God's gift of faith to us when we say, like, oh yeah, well, I don't think I'm very faithful because I didn't really want to come to church today. Well, but you came.
Yes.
That's actually, that's evidence of faith. Like, you came even though, like, your flesh didn't want to. That's an act of faith.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I think that characterizing faith the way you just did is really helpful. And it's the way Hebrews does it, right? Faith and sight are the things that are like opposed, but not faith and knowledge. That's different. And oftentimes what people mean by blind faith culturally is like faith in the face of evidence that says no. And that's not what we're getting at. And it's not what Hebrews is getting at all. All of these people had great, good reason to trust God when they did. He had shown himself to them and they knew him actually in personal relationship. It wasn't just an idea or a wish that they had, that they were just really hoping this comes true. It was based on something really solid, God's character. And that's what we have as well. And I couldn't help but be struck, Jay, like as you were walking through. So just to refresh memories here, if your memory is like mine, it's Tuesday, so you need to be reminded of what these five things were. So we just talked about, we try to hide our doubt. The next one was we listen to the wrong voices. So doubt like feeds off of doubt. We kind of turn to other doubtful voices. The third one was that we focus on our circumstances rather than God. So the circumstances are really big and God is really small. The fourth one is that we get fixated on a particular outcome of like how God will meet our need. It has to be this way and this is what we need. And if he doesn't in that way, we start to doubt him. And then the last one was that we underestimate the power of small faith and the necessity of just these regular, everyday, mundane acts of faithfulness that play into whether or not we can trust God. And all of those to me, they were all really good reasons of why it is essential for us as followers of Jesus to know his word, to really know what he has said and to understand his character and what he is like, actually, how he has been revealed by God to be and how God has shown us who he is. Because that is, to me, what is at stake over and over and over again. Who is God? What is God like? And how does he then interact with us as human beings? And every day of our life, we seem to be, it could be any one of those five or all five of those things that you talked about, and any day. And the way that we answer them over and over again is by going back to, who are you, God? How do you interact with us? And what have you done for this situation to meet this need? And we won't know that unless we know him through his word, because his word is solid and it's not changing. Our understanding of his word is that's different. We can be changing and growing and misunderstanding and then learning more. But to me, it was just a really, I was thinking at the end, like, this is why it is essential that we just have a habit of being in his word and knowing him. So I guess I'm curious, Jay, like just hearing that about the word and about like doubt, what comes to your mind as ways, you know, we don't have to walk through all five of these right now at all, but what comes to mind is ways for people to, I was going to say get out ahead of, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, just have the habits, the healthy habits of these small acts of faithfulness that are then informed by his word on a daily basis. So we've talked about this before, but I'd like to get really specific about what could this look like to live in the places of faith that we know we have right now, rather than focusing on our doubt from his word.
That's a good question. I mean, the first thing that pops in my head is just, I want to reiterate kind of what you said about his, about being in the word and knowing him. That's ultimately what will encourage our faith, is knowing him and his character. Mm-hmm. So think about how often, and I've done this, so this is not a knock on anybody, and it's not always unwise, but how often we'll have some kind of decision or thing going on in our life, and what do we want to do? We want to say, okay, where in the Bible does it talk about this thing? Like, where does it talk about money? Because I have this financial decision to make. Where does it talk about forgiveness? Because I have to like figure out, how do I forgive? Where does it talk about, you know, like whatever. That's why we have the concordance. That's why we have like in the back of the book and back of the Bible, and you say like, oh, I need hope right now, and so let me find verses of hope. I get that. And there are some very tangible things that it would be good to know, you know, like, you know, I'm doing premarital counseling right now for a couple. Well, it's good to talk about, what does the Bible say about marriage? That's an important mm-hmm. topical study to do. And that's valuable. But what matters the most in any of those things is knowing God intimately, his character, how he acts. That's why when we talk about reading the Bible, that it's not just about the content that you get out of it. It's not to say the content isn't important, or that we don't need to learn how to read the Bible so that we know, like, it's really important to know, is this a historical narrative? Is this a parable? Is this poetry? Is this, like, all those things are important. But the most important thing is you're actually hearing God's voice and learning how he interacts and how he speaks and what does he sound like when he says, like, when he confronts sin and when he talks about justice and when he talks about the church and when he, you know, you think about the gospels and how Jesus interacts. That, being really confident in that, is the best thing you can do for your faith day to day. It's not knowing, you know, like, think about when Jesus talks about them worrying about what they will eat or what they will wear. He does give an example, like knowledge, like an informational example of, like, look at the birds. They eat. Look at the flowers. Like, they're dressed. But what does he say? Like, the reason why that's important is he says, and your father cares about you more. Like, you're more valuable to him. That's a character thing. It's not a question of, well, this is how you're going to get your food, or this is how it, this is all, or this is the way this works. If you work hard, you'll get to eat something. If you do this, and, like, there's wisdom in all of that. But ultimately the faith that Jesus is talking about that will take away your worry is trusting the character and the nature of your father and his love for you. Mm-hmm. So that's like I wish I had something else that is more profound than, like, what we try to talk about all the time of get to know him, listen to him, spend time with him, like practicing his presence, being with him, using your imagination rightly. Like, you talk about using your imagination rightly or wrongly, your imagination rightly of, not imagining in the sense that you're making things up, but imagining of, like God is with you right now. I mean, I've been having this conversation a lot with people lately of what changes if you understood the reality that God is with you right now. Mm-hmm. How does that change? You know, I've used the example before where, like, early on in my marriage, being kind of critical and saying some things to Lauren. And I remember one time being at her parents' house and, like, having this critical thing pop up, but I didn't say it because her dad was standing right there, and having this weird realization of why would I stop saying this thing to her in front of her earthly father, but have no qualms at all of saying this to her in front of her heavenly father. Mm. Like, it's just so surreal and so weird that I would feel more held in check or more convicted in that moment because of her earthly father than I would, like, her heavenly father. And I asked a guy recently this week, I just said, like, he's just dealing with some temptations. I was like, if I just hung out with you all the time, it was just with you all the time, how would that change, like, your choices? And he's like, oh gosh, I wouldn't do any of those things. Mm-hmm. Like, well, if you wouldn't do any of those things because I'm with, like, if I'm with you just because I'm there, like, how much more, you know, if Jesus was there. And the reverse is true. If they're nervous about something or they're struggling with something, like, well, how much encouragement would you get if I was just hanging out with you all the time? Oh, that would be so encouraging. It'd be so helpful. Well, if that's encouraging for me, like, how much more is Jesus, and, like, knowing that he is actually with you, not, mm-hmm. not, like, just in theory and not as, like, a inspirational idea, but actually with you. So, in all the things, it all just comes back to reminding myself constantly he is with me, and then knowing enough from his word and spending enough time with him and practicing those small steps of faith enough that actually brings comfort. And I actually know, you know, what it is that he's offering or doing in that moment. So that's not just a general idea, because you can just say, like, oh, God is with me, but you don't know who God is, and you don't know how he interacts, and you don't know what he says because you're not in his word. And so you don't, it's just like, it's whatever you make up in your mind. That's not comforting.
No, because we can feel, we know when we're doing that, and we can feel like that we're trying to convince ourselves, you know, that something's going to be okay just by using our own minds versus knowing a person who's real and tangible and present. And I totally agree too. And I've said this in multiple sermons because it has struck me so much. But early on in my walk with Jesus, a mentor said to me, you know, one of the most important things that you will do every day is that you need to adjust yourself to the reality that you're living in God's presence. And I feel like that, I'm so thankful that that was said to me early on, because it's exactly true. I need every day to do that. And then if I know who he is based on who he's revealed himself to be, I can walk with him that day. And I think your point too about imagination is really important. And I feel like this is an area where I'm growing myself and being able to, the right use of my imagination when I'm reading scripture has been really, really helpful. So what I mean by that is, like, say you're reading a gospel and you come to an account of Jesus. So I have open in front of me here, Matthew 9. And the title of the section is Jesus raises a dead girl and heals a sick woman. And these miracles are happening. And you can read that and read like a chapter of those and read like three or four accounts really quickly and then go on with your day. Or what I would recommend is you slow down and you take just one of those examples and try and ask God for help doing this, but then try to put yourself there and see what you can see. So look at Jesus's face. Imagine who he is and what he's doing, and look at the faces of the people who are experiencing the things that he's doing, the way he talks. So when we read, we also are assigning tone, right, to Jesus's words. And what I'm basically describing is slowing way down. Slow way down as you read the Gospels, because it will help you get to know him, and you'll see things in him that you didn't see before as he interacts with people. And we need to be careful. We can misuse our imagination as we do that, so we don't ever make it authoritative. Like, well, of course he was, you know, this is how he sounded. Well, we don't know. But I do think we can have some spirit-empowered, like, imagination where we can get at a little bit more, what would it have been like? And the one where I'm in Matthew 9, when Jesus says he gets to the house, the synagogue leader's house, and he's going to basically bring this girl back to life. These people are outside playing pipes, which I believe must have been related to like burial and mourning. And he says, go away. This is what Jesus says. Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep. So even in that sentence, did Jesus say that in an angry way? Did he say it in a gentle, compassionate way? Because they couldn't have possibly understood what was about to happen. Like, we're doing all of that as we read it. And then their reaction is, but they laughed at him, which is just fascinating. So slow down enough to put yourself there and just see the faces laughing at Jesus. And what is his reaction to that? And as we do that again and again and again, I do believe by engaging more of our senses that God gave us, we'll start to get to know him in a new way that I believe will be very powerful for when we have those moments of asking, whether or not we use the words, of asking functionally, who are you? Who are you and what are you capable of right now? If you're with me, then what does that mean? How does that change the situation? So what that means is, I just had this conversation the other day. It's very difficult to do that if your time in the Word is solely a Bible reading plan that tries to get you through the whole Bible in a year. I think those are really helpful. They help us grow in our general knowledge of the Bible. But what I would say is, if you want to do that and then add this onto it. Add some time where you're slowing down and you're really meditatively going through a passage. And you might just pick one of the, so say you're reading in four places, which is often what those plans kind of lay out. In one of the places you're reading, really slow down in it rather than just kind of get through it. And because if you're like me, and I've done those plans and they've been helpful, I do reach a point where I am kind of just getting through it. And the bummer about that is I just miss all of this. Like what I just described there, I miss like seeing Jesus's face and seeing their reactions and really imagining the scenario. So there's just one exercise that's getting very practical. I know that was a bit laborious describing it, but I think it's helpful for us to try to draw out what has been helpful. And if you're listening to this, chances are God has brought something for you and the way you get into the Word that has been really helpful. And what I would encourage you is to meditate on that. Like what has really brought me life and insight as I've been in the Word? What has it been? Like, what do I actually do? And then I would encourage you to share that with someone and then ask them the same question. What has been helpful for you? Because I'm guessing, and I know in our church family, there are countless ways that people have learned over the years of actually hearing God's voice through his Word in a powerful way, in a not mechanical way. And what I want to do is, I think we can grow in our, basically our knowledge of each other and then our experience of God by asking each other, what has that been like? So I would encourage you, if you're hearing this and that does pique your imagination a bit and your interest, just think about it and then ask someone, what has been helpful? What's a tool? What's a way that you've done that that may be outside the box?
Yeah, and I agree with all that. I think that's awesome. And I think just even encouraging them, all of us, to talk to other people about it, you know, because that I brought up, you know, that idea that we listen to the wrong voices. It's just so critical that we just need each other. And that's what I was struck by when I was reading it and thinking, and I could have gone, I talked about Israel, obviously, because you just had this mass of, you know, 2 to 3 million people. We don't know how many people exactly are going across the sea. And that's got to be such a mixed bag, you know, of people who are just kind of going because, well, what else are we going to do? But if it was up to them, they wouldn't have crossed. You know, if it was up to them, they would have gone back. And they didn't. But you also see it, like with Abraham and Sarah, that how we could have talked about this. So we talked about Abraham's unfaithfulness, but it was Sarah's suggestion, right? Like it wasn't like Abraham stepped out on his marriage and Sarah's like, what are you doing? You know, like Sarah's the one that, you know, puts him up to it or says that I think you need to do this. So that's what happens. We kind of, we'll feed each other's doubt and grumbling and complaining and all that. And we'll feed off of that. And so a practical thing I would give as far as that kind of community is you want to make sure that when you have doubt and you're confessing it to God, and when you think about, I need help with, from other people in this, a faithful response to that is to receive a person's confession of lack of belief or unbelief or doubt and have compassion on that, and then gently proclaim faith. Like you're actually, so remember I said earlier, we're always this tension. And so as you confess doubt, we should also be confessing our belief. Well, in the same way, when we receive someone's confession of unbelief, it should look like I have compassion on like what Jesus gives. Like I have compassion on this. Like I know what that's like to feel that way. And I can see how you would, you know, why you'd be struggling in that. But let me tell you. And then to speak faith into that, so that you're being like a something for them to hold on to. So it's not a confronting or correcting even, and it could be like there could be gentle correction if there's like a confession of something false about God, of, you know, that they just don't know. Like there could be a lack of understanding that you could give, like, oh, actually God, we see this in scripture, you know, for example. But I think more what it is you're just kind of being some like a railing for them to hold on to in that moment. That's what we do when we pray for someone. When somebody says, could you pray for me? Cause I'm scared. What you're doing is you're being faith for them. Like you're being the thing that you're saying, you're praying the prayer of faith that they are struggling to pray right now. And you're doing it on their behalf. That's what intercession really is. It's why when the Spirit intercedes on behalf of us, like even when we don't know what to pray, that's a little bit what we do with other people. And so I'm saying that to say, you'll know you found a healthy person to confess your doubt to when they respond with understanding and also with a strength. One of the things that we struggle with is when we try to be strong for other people is we give false, we then feel like, oh, well then I have to be able to like put on this front. And so now I receive that. And so that's when we get things like, you know, people just, we just kind of throw out spiritual platitudes of, you know, like, oh, I'm sure it'll all be fine. Or, you know, God will take care of everything or whatever. But that's not what's helpful. What's helpful is typically specific things of, well, here's what I know. I know that God is with you. I know that no matter what, whatever happens, he will give you grace for the moment. And I know that we can bring our requests to him. often that's my response when someone is scared or struggling with a lack of faith, or they're dealing with circumstances that are daunting, like let's say a medical test or whatever. Those are kind of the big things that I respond with, of like, I understand their fear, compassionate about their fear and their doubt, or their, even if it's not specifically doubt, but just anything, that's just their unease and their confusion and their fear and all that. But then I also want to declare what we know. And typically in those situations, it's those things. What we know is God is with us. Mm-hmm. What we know is he hears our cries. What we know is that we're supposed to bring our petitions, make our requests known to God. And so we're going to do those things. We're going to tell God what we want, and we're going to declare the reality that we know that whatever happens, he will give us grace for the moment when we need it. Yeah. Which is different than just being like, oh no, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Totally different. Yeah. One is anchored into knowledge of a person and one is a wish.
Right.
It's just an optimism.
Right.
And it's good to be hopeful. That's not a bad thing, but just general optimism is very different than what you're describing. I think it's both sides of that coin, or like one coin, right? The empathy, the compassion for the person who's in the middle of it, because they're suffering in some way, you know, whether it's fear, doubt, whatever it is, and trying to acknowledge that is really difficult. And then also, but not leaving it there. I love that encouragement of saying, we know things about God. We've learned things about him in his word and in our experience, and we can share that then as well.
Yeah. And that's one of the things too, and you talk about getting fixated on a particular outcome. We kind of brushed over that, but we've talked about that before. You mentioned it last week on the podcast, I forget exactly how you worded it, but that the difference between a demand and a request is a demand is hinged on a specific outcome. Mm-hmm. Whereas a request is like, this is what I see, and I'm just going to tell you what I want. But I trust you to fulfill whatever is good and right. And so that's where a baby step, I would say, if you're sitting there and you're thinking, man, I have defaulted to that. I defaulted to feeding into that, being fixated on a particular outcome, you know, like whether it's a healing or a financial situation or job situation or relational, whatever. And so I've defaulted to just being like, oh no, I'm sure it'll be okay. Like you just have to believe and it'll be fine. If that's been you and you're like, how do I kind of change that? It's always helpful when dealing with someone who's in a situation like that to point them to the character and nature of God. Declare what you know about who God is, not about what you think he might do or how he might do something, but who he is and what you know about him. And the answer to doubt is always to trust the character and nature of God. It is not to minimize circumstances. That's one of the ways that we try to deal with doubt. Like, oh, it's, you know, I went through that too, and it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, like I think about my gallbladder surgery that I just had. That's like one of the simplest procedures. Like people do them, they happen all the time. But if I'm feeling doubt or fear in that, the world's way of comforting me is telling me how successful all of those surgeries are. But what's actually comforting is just knowing that God is God and he's good, you know, and so I can trust him. And so I just think, like, just be careful, be mindful of the other ways that we try to deal with people's doubt. And I think we do that sometimes because it makes us uncomfortable too. We buy into some of the same fears of like, oh, if you say that, and like, I don't know what to do with, you know, with your doubt. And so then we just try to say something that makes it, it really makes us feel better.
Like, right. We make it about us, which is, you know, understandable in that moment. You can feel a responsibility and feeling like, I want to do this well. But as soon as we do shift kind of the spotlight to be primarily on us, our response isn't going to be as helpful. It will be about us. And there's a way of, and we're describing a compassionate way of sharing what is true. There's also a way that is not compassionate, that is not helpful, that actually is discouraging when sharing what is true. So I would just say, like, be bold in that, and do it with compassionate love.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that in trusting Jesus as you're helping a friend or a family member, you can trust him with the outcome of that conversation.
Yeah.
You know, that's never on us what he wants to do with it.
I don't remember if it was you, somebody was, yeah, I think it was you, and maybe it was in a sermon or maybe it was in a conversation of asking the question of how does God view you?
Yep.
Right now. And I found that to be a really helpful question to ask people who are struggling in that. It exposes a lot. But even them, even when they know, like just even thinking about that for a second, just again, that's practicing his presence. So now I'm thinking, okay, how is God looking at you? What is his emotion right now towards you as you are afraid of this thing or you're struggling in this doubt? And that can be a helpful, that's a helpful not only exercise for them, but also for us as we think about how we should be responding to, because we should be mirroring that.
Yes.
So if a person, if you're thinking, oh, I think Jesus would have compassion on this person. And the, when he says, you know, you have little faith, it's hard to know the tone of any of that. I think there is a gentle rebuke, but there's also almost like a, like when you tell a kid, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be this way. Like there is a little bit of a, you know, like if you've ever seen someone in their circumstances and you're just looking at them and going, all you have to do is change your perception about this, and this 99% of what you're struggling with goes away, because of our misuse of our imagination or whatever the case is. And that is, I think, sometimes when Jesus is calling out our lack of faith, it's a little bit of a, it doesn't have to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I know why it is. And I know that you're there in it, and he has compassion on us in it. But also a calling to, you don't have to keep feeling this way. Like you can, there is a way out of this, and there is a way of faith that where, and that's when we end up looking at like Philippians 4 and other passages where you see, and we'll talk about that next week, of like, what does faith actually empower you to do? What is actually available to us? You know, even our small faith, like, you know, think about the mustard seed, and this will probably come up in the sermon, but when Jesus says that, I don't think it's just a rebuke of like, oh my gosh, if you had just any faith at all, you could go do this. I think it's also a statement of hope of saying, you don't have to have perfect faith. Like even a little bit of genuine faith is going to achieve some really great things. So I think it's also an encouragement in that.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Yeah. Well, you're just giving me the look like we've done enough. We've
every single podcast is an act of faith, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We start.
It is.
Jay and I sit down, we start. Yeah. We do not know where the finish line is going to be and what route we will get there, but we trust. We really do. We trust that God will carry us in the conversation, and I'm thankful. I checked before we got on today. This is our 249th podcast, so the next one's 250.
I used to say what number they
it's
were.
It's just wild.
We get back into that. Episode 2, yeah.
There was a time where we didn't do this, and now we've done it 249 times. Like someone has, not just always
right.
You and me.
Right.
But I'm thankful because I do know that we do have, we joke about it, but we do have a faithful listenership, and we have people that take what happens on here very seriously, and we're thankful for that. That is all God's grace when he uses this to encourage people. So we pray that's what this conversation did again today.
Yeah, it's our hope, and it is an act of faith. And if you're sitting there listening and you're saying, oh man, I wish they would have addressed this in the sermon because I had this question or whatever, that is a little plug for you to submit your questions. You can do it on a communication card. We always get the communication cards before we record the podcast. So you can put it on that, or you can email us at connect@faithpashtigo.com. Either with questions that you'd like us to address about the sermon or about anything else, or to just learn more about how you can get connected with others to walk this road of faith that we are all on together. So again, we're appreciative of you taking the time to listen. We hope it's been helpful to you. Until next time, grace and peace.